dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. I'm Lynn Gary. Yesterday was Earth Day, and today women marched in Washington, D.C. to protest the right-wing government's attempt to roll back hard-won gains under law. This election season, pollsters ask voters which issue they consider of top importance. The economy, the war, the environment, and so on. But the degradation of our biosphere, an economy of haves and have-nots, and resource wars under the guise of high-flown ideologies or bogus threats are part and parcel of a civilization based on hierarchy and commodification. Our featured speaker tonight, environmentalist and author Derek Jensen, argues that this civilization cannot save the environment or itself and must be brought down. Also, we conclude our readings from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. But first, a brief report from Israel and Palestine from Grace Ritter, an Ithaca resident who traveled to the Middle East with a peace delegation to be present for the release of Israeli anti-nuclear activist and whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu earlier this week. Vanunu had been in prison for the last 18 years after he made public Israel's secret nuclear weapons program. We spoke to Grace last Wednesday as she and other international peacemakers were on a bus en route to Bethlehem, on their way to the occupied territories where Palestinians are resisting Israel's construction of a 30-foot-high security wall, hundreds of miles long, that cuts Palestinian communities in half.
I am between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv on the highway. I am here with about 100 supporters of Mordechai Vanunu, and we have been vigiling outside of Ashkelon prison for the last 2 days. Today, at about 11:30, he was released from prison to a huge crowd of supporters and also counter-demonstrators. But he has had to find a safe space to go. A church in Jerusalem called St. George's Cathedral offered him sanctuary because the situation is very dangerous for him. And definitely at the prison today, we saw that there's a very, very violent sentiment towards him. So it's not safe for him to be living in a place where people are, who knows what people are going to be doing. But today at the prison, when he was released, people were trying to encourage him to get right into a car and be driven to a safe spot. But he walked out into the courtyard, and he was still within the prison walls, but he went up to the gate of the prison, and he climbed up on the gate and waved at everyone and made the peace sign and just opened himself up as a person of peace and unafraid of the people who were chanting against him. Then he spoke to his supporters. He had a huge smile on his face, was full of dignity. And to see someone who spent that much time in prison in solitary confinement and to meet them, it's very amazing, and to see that he still has this belief in the goodness of humanity, very warm. And we're also going to be going into the West Bank tomorrow and to work with Palestinian people who are also facing great hardship.
You spoke about the violent sentiment. I mean, what is that like?
Many of our group have T-shirts that say Vanunu on them or stuff like that, and walking down the street in Jaffa, many, many people would yell at them or make rude comments. And today at the vigil, there was a very large group of counter-demonstrators. They were chanting very inflammatory things, like, you should be killed just like Brindisi, or at one point they were throwing eggs at us, or once he got into the car and was driven away, they all charged after the car. The media coverage here, mostly it seems totally not in his favor, and it just seems like the majority of the people here are not standing with him. And it seems like a really, really horrible thing for him to face, especially the State of Israel will not grant him a passport at this point. It's one of the conditions of his release was that he would not be allowed to travel at all. That's among other things. Some of them have been lifted now. One of the restrictions was that he wouldn't be allowed to talk to any international people, any international media or people at all, and that has been lifted at this point. So that's part of the victory, and people are still going to keep working until he's given a full freedom.
They won't let him leave the country, yet it seems that the situation there for him in the country is very dangerous. Are they trying to set him up to be murdered, or what's going on there?
Well, I don't know if I would say I would go that far. I'm sure they know how dangerous the situation is, but I think that really they want to use him as an example for people in the future to not speak out against nuclear weapons. Or against other policies of the State of Israel. Use him as an example always to say, this is what happened to the Nunu, and it can happen to you too. Whatever happens to him upon release is just part of that.
Have you talked to any just ordinary people who oppose him? And if so, what do they say about him? What is their feeling that makes them so against him?
They feel that he is a traitor to the state, that he signed an oath that he would not speak about it, and he did speak about it. He broke that oath. And that that the State of Israel needs these weapons for their security, and that he's a traitor to the state because he, you know, since he doesn't want these weapons to exist. We will be heading, I think, to the Bethlehem area tomorrow, and we'll probably be in Ramallah soon, because there's a lot of resistance to the wall being built around there, particularly in a place called Bidu, B-I-D-D-U. People are going out every single day, Palestinians and internationals, to resist the wall being built. We'll probably end up around there at some point.
And are people doing blockading of the construction equipment, or what's happening there?
In many communities, every single day, the people of the village go out. A lot of times they're led by the women and children, sort of as a nonviolent force. Hopefully the soldiers wouldn't want to hurt women and children as readily as other people. But then people go out and stand in front of the bulldozers that are erecting this wall. Or, you know, do many different things. It then quite often turns into a scene where the soldiers are shooting tear gas and rubber bullets and sometimes live ammunition into the crowd. There have been a couple of Palestinians killed recently in Bidu during these protests from live ammunition used on protesters. Many internationals are there, and really, people in the U.S. need to know about what is happening with their tax dollars. A huge wall is being built to imprison a whole population of people, and it's a racist policy. It's a horrible policy. It's against many, many different U.N. policies. And
how do the U.S. taxpayer dollars figure into it?
Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. military aid. They receive somewhere between $4 and $5 billion a year in U.S. military aid.
This sounds like a very dangerous situation that you're going into, Grace. How do you personally feel about that? Are you afraid? I mean, people have been killed. Rachel Corey was run over by a bulldozer. Other people have been shot, other internationals.
I think that it's important to know those risks. And yes, I expect I'll be very nervous, but I also feel that it's definitely responsibility of Americans to be there because of what our government does all over the world. People are very, very angry with the U.S. government. We need to let the world know that the people in the U.S. are not calling for these policies, and that we really need to stand in solidarity with the people who these policies are being put on and take those risks with them, as well as being willing to risk what the U.S. service people in Iraq are risking. In the name of war and destruction, they're risking death and risking killing people. And so in the name of life and peace, I feel like I should put my body in the way.
Grace Ritter speaking last Wednesday from Israel. The talk we're about to hear by Derek Jensen was given in February at the Synergy 2004 Third Annual Sustainable Living Conference at Evergreen University in Olympia, Washington.
Oh, this, by the way, is how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. So I'm not really sure what we should do today. I had a few ideas. We could either talk about the culture of make-believe, or we could sort of go straight to Q&A, or we could talk about the book I'm working on right now, which is a book about how to take down civilization. Yes. I have to tell you, it is so good to be back in the West, because of the response you just gave. I just did an East Coast tour, New England, and whenever I would say that my new book is about how to take down civilization, they would all look at me and go, So it's so great to be back where people know what the hell's going on. So I was thinking that since we have a choice, since there's multiple things we could do, that since we live in a democracy, that's actually my best joke of the afternoon, we could take a vote. And then I would just go ahead and ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. I'll tell you why there is not going to be an anarchist revolution. Because I was down in Florida a couple years ago doing a talk, and then afterwards about 10 or 11, that was about 12 or 13 of us anarchists were going to go out to dinner. We stood in the parking lot for 45 minutes trying to come to consensus on who was going to get in which car. And we never did. Actually, we never did come to consensus. Finally, this one woman said, okay, you three this car, you four this car, you three this car. I'm like, cool, great. So that's how the revolution is going to come, is just this woman has to call it. So that said, we did get, I was sort of thinking it might be kind of fun to just go straight to Q&A, but it was a really positive response for the takedown civilization stuff. So why don't I just, yeah, for which? Okay. The people have spoken. Can somebody make the lighting less terrible? I'm very dim. I was bright and then I got dim. I was at Syracuse, New York last spring, and we couldn't make the AV system work. And I don't think you can say you've lived until you've seen a half dozen anarcho-primitivists try to work an AV system. So is this better? Are we happy now? Okay. So are you gonna stay here on call? Or are you gonna?
Is there anything else anyone needs?
Hey, can we do stereo effects? Okay, so what I'm doing with the new book, it's pretty funny because after language, which was pretty big, and then culture, which was really big, my former publisher challenged me to write a short book, so I wrote two, and then this new book on how to take down civilization, I think I'm on page 526, I think. I'm about halfway done. It's another big one. Okay, so what I'm doing in the new book is I'm going through and I'm stating my premises in boldface. And the reason I'm doing that is because I've heard it said that the first rule of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, for example, and I don't want to do that. So, for example, if you hear a talking head say, how can we best make the U.S. economy grow? Okay, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? But they've got you asking different questions. Of Hitler, it was said that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And that's really true, once again. Once you accept certain premises, you can go ahead and commit whatever atrocities you want and have them fully rationalized. And once again, I don't want to do that. Okay, so we're going to jump tracks here, which is not going to surprise anybody who's read any of my books. And we're going to go a different direction for a second. And I think it's pretty safe to say that the environmental movement is an abysmal failure. And almost no matter what measure you go by, we're not winning. We don't even slow, not only do we not slow the rate of deforestation, we don't even slow the rate of acceleration of deforestation. And I'm sure you know that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service did give an important response to that. And NIMS, of course, is the organization that is tasked with overseeing the murder of the oceans. And what his response was just a direct quote, "We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable." As a longtime grassroots environmental activist and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and fall into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that horses were afraid to get in the water for fear that, well, because they were afraid, and maybe so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize? So large they'd keep people awake at night with the slapping of their tails against the water. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time. The death of flocks of Eskimo crews just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take global warming. Give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you finally use that word." Thanks, George. So I read a really interesting book a few years ago called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And in this book, he asked the question, how is it that these people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go in and participate in a death camp? And he found something very interesting, which is that many of the doctors actually acted in the best interests of the Jews. And they did everything they could to help improve the condition of the Jews, except question the larger framing conditions in which they found themselves. So if a Jew got sick, they might hand him an aspirin to lick, or they might put him to bed for a couple days. Or if he had a contagious disease, they might kill him so that he wouldn't give this disease to others. And his point was that they were doing all these wonderful things that they could. Wonderful is kind of ironic, but they were doing the best they could within the Auschwitz reality. They weren't questioning assembly line mass murder. They weren't questioning working them to death, starving them to death. They weren't questioning the overall cultural racism that led to this. And I think a lot of us as environmentalists end up finding ourselves in similar positions, that we're doing what pathetically little is available to us without questioning the larger superstructure. So that's one of the things I want to do today, is try to sort of blow out that superstructure as much as possible. Okay, premise one of the current book is industrial civilization. We got off the word industrial, but industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding a car with a friend of mine, George Raffin, and I was just making conversation. I said, so if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George can be kind of a curmudgeon, and that day he was in kind of a foul mood and said, you know, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question is what's going to be left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't going to last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, whereby there are fewer salmon who come back every year than the year before, isn't sustainable. In fact, you can also say, and I think this is really true, that any way of life based on the use of resources isn't sustainable, because resources don't actually exist. There is no such thing as a resource. What there are is there are salmon whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and trees whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and rivers whose lives are as valuable to them. And it's only after they're converted to resources. It's like there's this great line by this Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And what that means is when he looks at trees, he doesn't see trees. He sees, obviously, dollar bills. He sees resources. And if you see them as resources, you're going to use them up. And this doesn't mean, and we're jumping again, no surprise, but this doesn't mean that you can't eat them, you can't kill them. A few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and the radio interviewer said, well, you know, Indians ate salmon too. Oh, no, I'm sorry, he didn't say that. He said, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew it was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, so I had to give an answer. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to a tree, and I asked the tree, so what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer just like that, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I eat salmon from a particular run, I'm now responsible for that run's continuation. And if a grizzly bear eats salmon, they're now responsible for that continuation. And this is true on a moral level, it's true on a spiritual level, it's true on a physical level, because if you don't do it, the run's not going to continue, as we see. And everybody knows this. Wood ducks know it, tadpoles know it, frogs know it, grizzly bears know it, everybody but us. Everybody but a few of us. Okay, so that's fine, Derek, that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. But what is civilization? You know, I've been bashing civilization for about 10 years, and I figure it's finally time I better define it. And the definition that I've come up with, which I think is really defensible, is civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's really fine, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. The first of them is, which means, by the way, that the Talawa and Yurok who lived and still live where I live weren't civilized. They lived in villages, they lived in camps. And I'm using civilization as pejorative, by the way. And they didn't require the importation of resources. The Talawa and Yurok would eat salmon, huckleberry, salal, salmon, elk, salmon, crabs, salmon, clams, salmon, 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 salmon. They would also, I don't know if you know this, but they'd also eat salmon. And anyway, so a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is your way of life is not and can never be sustainable. Because if you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, once again, I don't believe in resources, but it's shorthand here. If you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, that means that, and you require its importation, as your city grows, you're going to denude an ever larger area of that particular resource, as we see. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for this item, and if you need it, you're going to take it. And so what this means is that we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't matter the U.S. would still have a large military, because how the hell else are we going to get access to all the oil that we need? So we could all hold hands and sing Give Peace a Chance, and the military is going to march on. Okay. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities don't often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. Following quick on that is the third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Oh, and then we get to a really fun one. This is a great premise. Okay, civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is either transparent or fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And the way this can work on a family level, those of you who've read Language know that my father's extremely violent. Broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And within our family, the violence would flow that direction. He could be violent with impunity. But the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he'd committed blasphemy. And similarly, I don't know if it's been in the paper here, all over New England people had heard about this, that a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, there was a mountain biker killed by a mountain lion down in L.A. And this, of course, makes news everywhere. But not many people know that they're building houses on some of the last Florida panther habitat in Florida. And so it's very, you know, one time, you know, the one time that a shark bites a human, that's a big deal. But sharks are being driven systematically extinct. And, you know, I don't really like Bob Melvin. I think he should be fired. It's a baseball joke. So similarly, there's you know, when there were 3,000 people killed on 9/11, that's a big deal. But there's more people than that die of preventable cancer in the United States every like 3 or 4 days. There's more children than that die around the world because of U.S. domestic and foreign policies every same deal 3 or 4 days. And so there's this fetishization of the victims when it goes the other direction. The fifth premise of the book is that the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives below. So those above can acquire more property, that is make more money, by destroying the lives of those below. But if those below destroy the property of those above, then the lives, and that's called, the first is called production, by the way, and if those below damage the property of those above can destroy the lives of those below, and that's called justice. And we all know the example, you know, Jeff Lures, 22 years for torching 3 SUVs, and which is far more than you get if a man rapes a woman or if a man beats his wife to death, his wife. So that's that hierarchy in operation. The sixth premise is a fun one, too. Civilization isn't redeemable. Our culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. I ask people all over the country, do you think that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh, even in New England. And so the question becomes, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know, because we don't talk about it, because we spend so much time trying to pretend that we have hope. And it's killing us. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And one of the ways they did that was by making it so that it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist at every step of the process. So, would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto? You want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something really interesting. which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. Oh, we're going to jump another direction too, which is the 10th premise of the book is that the culture as a whole, most of its members are insane. I don't really need to talk about that, do I? If I could get across one thing in my work, it would be that the government is a government of occupation and the culture is a culture of occupation. And of course, all of my American Indian friends are telling me what the hell took me so long to figure that one out. I'll read a short little thing from the new book, if I can find it. Okay, here we go. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Yeah, we'd think about the baseball season. What would we all do if they implemented... Goddamn Grady Little, by the way, for keeping Pedro Martinez in. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. That was Mussolini, by the way, not Chomsky. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, or following Mussolini, corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Oh, I'll tell you my secret fantasy, which won't be secret after this, which is that the next time they have one of those WTO or FTAA or whatever meetings, that all the cops suddenly turn around and they start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because they have a lot more in common with us than they do with them. And that's happened before. That actually happened. It was in 1880 in Pennsylvania. The militia handed over their guns to the strikers. It also happened at the Bastille, where when they stormed the Bastille, all the guards suddenly turned and killed their officers, which should always be encouraged. So would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because... Hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? It's like, we're all so crazy. If space aliens came down from outer space, I guess that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically deforest the planet, to vacuum the oceans, and to give dioxin, to put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Every stream. I mean, it's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. And if they did that, I mean, what would we do? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that if space aliens were doing all of this, that we would all just put on our camo outfits and grab our AK-47s and head off to the woods. Am I like the only person here with an AK-47? Or has anybody seen the movie Red Dawn? Oh, isn't that the greatest? I love that movie. Okay, the movie is about the commies invade from Central America. The Cubans and Soviets come in through Nicaragua. They fly up to the United States. They don't fly United, and they never get here. And they get stopped in Colorado by a bunch of jocks and cheerleaders. And I think we should make that our theme movie, except just dub it. And every time they say commies, just put in capitalists, and there we go. That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people in here have loved someone who's died of cancer? No, I'm not going to say that. How many people have loved someone who got killed by cancer? That's what, 70, 80%? Which, of course, cancer is a disease of civilization. Who is the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? The head of South African security, after South Africa was no longer apartheid, the head of security before then said that the thing he'd really been afraid of with the ANC was not their sabotage or even the violence, as it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of people to not have respect for law and order. Because he said no security force in the world can deal with that. So if we can recognize that sometimes law and morality coincide, and quite often, of course, they don't. Anyway, would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues, or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. So, when I say fight back, I don't mean only picking up guns. I mean, certainly that's one part. But the wonderful thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where we look, there's great work to be done. And so, if your heart carries you to work on a battered women's shelter, that's really important. If it carries you to work on a rape crisis hotline, that's great too. If it carries you to file timber sale appeals, great. I mean, even voting, for crying out loud. People ask me sometimes if I vote, and I say, you know, we all have these dirty habits that we're ashamed of. The thing is, there's this strategy that was used by Robert E. Lee at the Battle of Chancellorsville called Hammer and Anvil, where you take part of your army and you leave it here as the anvil, and you take part of your army here and you take it around and smash the enemy in between, and that's your hammer. And part of what I think we need to do, we have a fair number of people acting as anvils, and I don't think we have enough people acting as hammers to try to go on the offensive. All of our environmental work is really, for most part, is pretty defensive. And I mean, I can't speak for any of you, but it's not good enough for me to simply have salmon or grizzly bears or lynx or bobcat live out another generation or two of harried life before they ultimately get exterminated. You know, I want more than that. I want to actually live in a world where there's more wild salmon come back every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds, and where there's... I'll do what it takes to get there. Which actually brings us back to hope, that one of the things that kept my mother in the relationship with my father was the false hope that he would change. And another thing that kept her in the relationship, obviously, was that there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But the main one that I want to talk about is the false hope that he would change. And I was at a dinner get-together thing not very long ago with an attorney from what used to be Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, I guess it's Earth Justice now, and also with a funder for Earth Justice. And there's some other people too there too. And the attorney was saying, you know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay. And, you know, if we can just take over the House and Senate, and, you know, I was thinking, well, maybe, if it depends on who we is. I mean, if she means Democrats, then no. But I don't think she also meant storming the House and Senate either. So they're saying all this about how, you know, if we could just get a Democrat in the White House, things would be okay. And my mom was at the dinner, and she said, you know, the Democrats are just as controlled by corporations as the Republicans are. And everybody sort of leaned away and wrinkled their noses as though my mom had just explosively farted. And there was silence for a few moments, and then somebody said, I'm sorry, could you pass me the chips, please? And then, of course, I started talking about baseball. And anyway, so does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? And does anybody think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, that was what kept the Jews in line, you know, the false hope that if they are just good enough, perfect enough, that the dreadful won't happen. But I don't want to just bash false hope. I actually want to bash hope, too. I was at a talk last spring, and you know, I was just doing my fun little bashing hope thing, and somebody said in the audience said, "So can you define hope, please?" I was like, "Oh, I've never done that. I mean, I've been bashing it for years. I have no idea what it is." And so I asked the audience, "Can you come up with a definition of hope?" And they did, and it was a great definition. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because I don't hope I'm going to eat something this evening. You know, they say males are afraid of commitment. I'm committing to it in public right here. I'm going to eat something tonight. And on the other hand, the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash. I have no control over that. So the point is, if you say, "I hope that salmon survive," what you're doing is you're acknowledging that you're fundamentally powerless. I don't hope that coho and Chinook salmon survive. Once again, I will do what it takes to make sure they survive. If they want to go extinct because they don't like how they're being treated, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, they're not going to go extinct because I won't allow it to happen. I mean, it's really simple. What we need to do, if we want to make sure salmon don't go extinct, once again, as long as they don't want to go extinct, and who could blame them, frankly, is we need to take out dams, we need to stop deforestation, we need to stop global warming, and we need to stop commercial fishing. And those are all very straightforward technical tasks. If this were space aliens doing it, 1, 2, 3, 4, done deal. Okay, the longer, if our culture is not going to undergo any sort of voluntary transformation, if we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm the humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 150 years ago, the people in this region would still have a lot of salmon to eat. If it would have happened 200 years ago, people in the Midwest and New England would still have passenger pigeons to eat. I mean, passenger pigeons and salmon and Eskimo curlews and all of them have the right to survive, of course, we'll talk about rights in a second, have the right to survive on their own, but even on the level of straight calories. You know, there's going to be people 50 years from now on the Columbia River, they'll be glowing for one thing, and they'll be saying, "Now there are no salmon here and I'm starving to death because you allowed those in power to have cheap electricity for beer cans." And that's not a legacy, once again, I'm willing to bear. That the longer we wait, if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 80 years ago, there wouldn't be dioxin in every mother's breast milk. The longer we wait, the worse that's going to be. Eighth premise, the needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. I'll say it again. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. Can you imagine any politician saying that? It's just so, it's absolutely absurd. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up, oh my God, oh we have 45 minutes, good. I was thinking we had like 15 minutes left. Anyway, the psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also the three rules of a dysfunctional culture. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. And what this meant within my own family structure is that we could talk about anything we wanted except for the violence that wasn't happening. And then, of course, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And we also couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And then in addition, we couldn't talk about the fact that violence wasn't happening. One more thing. We couldn't talk about the fact that violence wasn't happening. Because if we would have talked about the fact that we couldn't talk 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 about the violence that wasn't happening, there would have been violence happening for us to not be talking about. Is that clear? And on the larger social scale, we can talk for years about whether the president did or didn't get a blowjob, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can talk about Pedro Martinez, and why did they spend so much on Raul Ibanez? I mean, I think he's pretty good, but in one good year, and he gets, what is it, $4 million or something? It's insane. I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes a vision of Angelina Jolie will rise up before me. She'll stand suspended in space. Makes me happy. It also makes me a little nervous, too. I don't think she has very good taste in men. Who's the new guy? God damn him. He's a bad boy too, but it's an improvement over Billy Bob. Oh my God. You know the thing about the vial? He each had a vial of the other person's blood around their neck? Do you know that? And then do you know where she has his name tattooed? Oh my God, I bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it has to be true. I'm sorry, does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? No, this place. I'm sorry?
Cheatwood.
And what's the indigenous name? What did the indigenous people...
That's where it was.
Cheatwood. Oh, okay. 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 I find it really strange that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, but it took me about 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. And then if you go another mile, there was another massacre at a place called Achillet. And if you go a mile over here, there was a massacre at a place called Lake Earl. And it's so weird that I know that Yvonne Rodriguez just signed a 4-year contract with the Detroit Tigers, and which I think is a little bit, 4 years for a catcher his age, I think is not a very good move. And I can't name 15 species of plants and animals who live within 150 yards of my home who've been harmed by civilization. I can't even name 10 species of plants who live within 100 yards of my home that are edible. Blackberry. Huckleberry. Salal. Blackberry. You know, somebody told me that, I mean, I know about dandelions, but the local dandelions actually aren't dandelions, I found out, and they're actually not, down where I live, in Northern California, they're actually not edible. I found that out. I was thinking, I know they're not plants, but it's close enough. Those big red mushrooms with the white dots, I'm thinking about trying one of them next year. Well, there's lots of them, so yeah, I could probably survive all winter on them. And they do have bites out of them, by the way. I'm thinking it's probably little rabbits or something. Anyway, I think it's really weird. Oh, and it's not just the Artie Lang's rules that make it so we don't pay attention to the things. And we're talking about the vacuuming of the oceans. Here we go. Here's a little quiz. So seeing patterns is supposed to be one form of intelligence. I'm gonna throw out this pattern. We'll see if we can recognize a pattern in less than 6,000 years. Okay, so when you think of a rack, is the first thing you think of like cedar forests that are so thick that the sunlight never reaches the ground? That's actually what I think of. The first written myth of this culture is that Gilgamesh went out and cut the forests of what is now Iraq. And then we think of Saudi Arabia, and the first thing you think of course, is dense oak forests, right? And then you go a little bit further west to like Lebanon, you think of cedars. I mean, they've got one on the flag. And then Israel, I talked to this guy from Israel a couple years ago, and I said, do you have trees in Israel? And I don't know, I've never been there. And he said, yeah, we watered them one by one. And Greece had lions and was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. When you think of North Africa, Libya, I mean, I think of just dense forests immediately. As this culture has metastasized across the globe, it's been deforesting its way all around. There's a great line by Plato, I believe it is. Plato observed, what now remains of the hills, compared with what then existed, is like the skeleton of a sick man, all the fat and soft earth having wasted away, and only the bare framework of the land being left. There are some mountains which now have nothing but food for bees, but they had trees not very long ago. I just read not very long ago that there was some king in England, like 13th century or something, outlawed dams because they kill salmon. And nowadays, I mean, the power planning council is still studying whether dams kill salmon. It's all pretty pathetic. Pretty bobo pathetic. Any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least, disallowing it from damaging your land base. Oh, I never finished my deal a minute ago about the perception, that it's not just R.D. Lang's rules that make it so we can't see. In the 1960s, this guy Lester Laborsky did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and they would track where they would look, which makes me think it was probably John Ashcroft's uncle or something. And it's like, here you go, Johnny, a nice little Christmas present. And what he found, he showed people photographs, and what he found is if the photograph contained something that the person found morally objectionable or that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once track to it, not once. Which means that they would see it out of the corner of their eye, and they would know where not to look. So, for example, he showed people photographs. In the background was a man reading a newspaper, and the foreground was a silhouette of a woman's breast. And the people who found nudity morally objectionable, their eyes would never once track to the breast. Never once. And when they were asked later, was there a breast in the photograph, they would say no. And they weren't lying, except unconsciously to themselves, because they never saw it. They never looked there. It's like I had this friend who said she wishes she could just shake George Bush, which I like that part. And then she said, I would just say to him, you know, that you could do so much to slow deforestation or stop deforestation. How about that? So much to stop global warming, so much to stop militarization, huh? And I said to her, look, I know exactly what he would say to you. He would say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Which, of course, with George Bush would come from multiple sources. And it's like the head DEA guy in Colombia several years ago, his wife was arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And the story they told was that she was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and never see it. It's possible that this was a story they told to keep him out of prison. It's also possible that it would have been so threatening to his perception of their marriage that he could not see it. He absolutely couldn't see it. We don't have to go. We do this all the time. I mean, I don't know if I'm the only person in this room who's ever been in a really shitty relationship. It's nice to be among a support group. Thank you. I mean, there's nothing worse than me saying that at a talk, and it's just dead silence in the room. It's like, well, I'm feeling kind of vulnerable now. Anyway, so I mean, there was no evidence at all that she's the single most selfish person in the entire world. The evidence wasn't there. And then you may have dated the same woman. And then when any of my friends would attempt to point this out to me, I would say, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then when the thing's over, it's like, oh my God, how did they not see that? And so once again, we do that. That's how we can have 80% of us have had someone we love killed by cancer, and we still just soldier on. Did I mention, by the way, that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along? Okay, here's another premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There are just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of green paper. Those without the green papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. A couple things about that. One of them is, well, I guess it's one thing. At a talk I did last year, afterwards, this one guy said, you know, you talk a lot about violence and this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. You know, I'm not a violent guy. And I said, okay, first off, where's your shirt made? And he said, Bangladesh. I said, okay, do we even need to talk about that? He said, no. I said, next, do you pay rent? And he said, yes. I said, why do you pay rent? He said, because I don't own. I said, no, no, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, well, somebody would come and evict me. And I said, who? He said, well, a sheriff. I said, what would happen if when the sheriff came, you invited them into your house? And you said, would you like some dinner? And then after dinner, you said, you know, it's been nice having you, but you're really not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave now, and I'm going to go to bed. What would the sheriff do? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out a gun, and he would force me out of the home. And I said, ah, I see. So what you're telling me is that if you don't pay rent, somebody with a gun is going to come and force you out of your home. So the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, somebody is going to do violence to you if you don't. And he said, okay, I get it. And I said, also, do you ever get hungry? He said, yeah. I said, well, when you get hungry, do you go to the grocery store? He said, yeah. And I said, well, do you start eating? There's lots of food there. And he said, no, I don't. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, because if I do, then somebody with a gun will come and take me away. And I said, yeah, it's the same guy. He's a real asshole, isn't he? the point is, I think it's really weird that we have to actually pay to exist, to live on the planet. And we have to actually pay to eat. And if you don't, some asshole wearing a uniform is going to come with a gun and take you away. That's a really, really weird thing. Some bobo, sorry. Here's a great premise. Oh, we're doing great. Here's a great premise. Love does not imply pacifism. You get this all the time. That, you know, if you love enough, then that means that you'll never do any act of violence. And, well, first off, violence is just such a weird word. There should be like 135 words for violence because there's a bazillion different types of, well, there should be a bazillion words for violence because there's a bazillion different types. I mean, it's one form of violence to rape and torture and mutilate and kill a child, and it's another form of violence entirely to step in and stop a person from doing that. And it's one form of violence to eat a carrot, and it's another form of violence to eat a cow, and it's another form of violence to, you know, those are all different. You can't use one word to describe all of them, but nonetheless, we're going to use that just like resource. We're going to condense it all for a second. Love doesn't imply pacifism. That a lot of people say if you just love enough that you would never do any act of violence. And I don't think that Mother Grizzly Bears would agree. I have a newspaper article above the space where I work that says, the headline is Mother Bear Charges Trains. And the trains had killed her two sons, and so she began to charge every train that came by. I grew up around animals, and I've lived around animals my whole life. And in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, chickens, hawks, eagles, hummingbirds, spiders, and mice who thought that I was attacking their children. And if a mother mouse is going to attack someone 6,000 times her size to protect those she loves, what's going on with us? She won, by the way.